From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Michigan millennial explains why she supports Donald Trump.
We want to know that our homes are secure, that our country is secure, that our husbands and ourselves, that we will have employment, that our schools will be safe.
Lessons learned from the lives of seniors who meet every week for coffee and conversation.
If we don't capture these stories for posterity, they're gone for good.
Her physician father worked to find the cause of bipolar disorder while battling the same disorder. Writer Mimi Barrett unravels a 70-year-old story.
That was the era where you didn't talk about what was happening. The next day was just sweetness and light, as if nothing had happened.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up, the first ever African-American teacher in the Lansing School District gets recognized for her life's work. But first, she's Jewish, a woman, a millennial, and she supports Donald Trump for president. That's how Lena Epstein introduced herself in a recent opinion piece she wrote for the Washington Examiner. Lena Epstein is the third-generation owner and general manager of Vesco Oil, based in Southfield. And she's one of five Michigan co-chairs of the Trump campaign, and she is with us now. Lena, welcome to Stateside.
Cindy, thank you so much for having me.
Tell me, when did you decide that you were casting your support to Donald Trump?
I was one of the early supporters when there were 17, 18 candidates on the stage vying for that one nomination. I was probably amongst my GOP peers, if not the earliest supporter, one of the top 10 earliest supporters that I know. I've been a Trump fan all along. For me, he's been the only option.
And why is that?
Donald Trump is the candidate of change. And he is the candidate of honesty, of candor, of relentless positivity, dare I quote our governor. He is going to make the next 8 years different. He is going to protect our borders. He is going to fight ISIS. He is going to protect Israel and reinvigorate America's education system in a way that no other candidate had a chance of doing. This is somebody that has made such great things in his life. He has proven time and time again to be a warrior and a hero, even when he's perceived incorrectly. I'm proud to support him, and I'm even prouder that there are institutions like your organization that want to hear about this.
What has it been like for you, Lena, especially in these recent months when you introduce yourself as a Trump supporter?
It's been very interesting. As a Jewish woman, we had the high holidays last week, and I was at Temple and in services, and it was very clear how polarizing amongst the Jewish community Donald Trump is. Those that care very much about Israel love Donald Trump because they know that he will protect the Middle East and make the world more secure overall. And then there are those Jewish people who are more concerned about social issues, less concerned about the economy and America's security, and they came right up to me and told me that they were mad at me. And of course, being a woman, I'm one of two female co-chairs for the Trump campaign for Michigan. It's been a media onslaught. Every angle of the media has wanted to ask me, Lena, why do you support him? How, as a woman, can you still support him? And can I tell you my answer, Cindy?
Yeah, I want to hear your answer. Absolutely, Lena.
My answer is Donald Trump has made mistakes in the past. He has said inappropriate things. He has been rude. He has been disrespectful. I have never, ever apologized for him. I've never made excuses for him. But I am not judging my presidential candidate of choice based on that type of inappropriate behavior. I see that as limited in scope, and I look at the bigger issues in determining how I vote on November 8th. In other words, he can say something inappropriate about women, but what I care about most of all, will the economy grow? Will we be safe? Will America have a future? Donald Trump is Donald Trump. Would I want him to be my children's Sunday school teacher? Probably not. Would I want him to be president of the United States? Cindy, you better believe it.
When we hear the Access Hollywood bus tape, and we hear women stepping forward with allegations of sexual abuse and misbehavior, Does that not tell us something about the essence of this person, the character of this person?
I think it tells us an essence of the media. You know, first of all, when you use the word allegation, that's exactly what it is. It's an allegation. It's not been proven in the court of law. I think we need to remember that. And I think it's also important to remember, and I'm looking at some data in front of me, that the coverage of Donald Trump's comments compared to the coverage of Hillary Clinton's inappropriate comments are 10 to 1. And so it makes it impossible to move beyond a weak moment, an inappropriate moment, to look at the bigger issues. And so I don't think that it is a comment on him as a person. When you look at the family that he's made, the businesses that he has made and grown, the things that he has done, the charitable interests that he's had in this world, this is a good man. This is a good, fine man. And you know what? He does sometimes put his foot in his mouth. And it's made my job very, very difficult over the last week trying to explain why I support, but I am steadfast. I think a lot about what women want, Cindy. And it is hurtful, and it can be offensive to hear Donald Trump say something inappropriate about a young girl or be rude or insensitive, and nobody wants to hear that. And nobody from the campaign, by the way, has ever pardoned it in any way, including Donald Trump, who apologized himself. But women, including myself, we want to know that our homes are secure, that our country is secure, that our husbands and ourselves, that we will have employment, that our schools will be safe, that we will be able to protect our families, that we don't have to face, God forbid, another war. These are the things that women care about. We want to know that we can band together as a community. We want to know that we can unite together. This divisiveness that has been the case between the Democrats and the Republicans scares every woman. I don't care what side of the aisle. But I think there's a lot of women's issues that are coming out in this campaign. One thing that has not been advertised, Donald Trump has made it clear that if he becomes president, he is going to enact and try to put into law much, much more freedom and flexibility for women in the workplace. More financial flexibility, more time flexibility, greater access to good child care on the job. These are a lot of things that the liberal media truly has not covered. And it makes me very, very sad.
I will say this, though. Mr. Trump has had, Lena, a lot of media coverage right from the beginning of his campaign, going right back to the announcement of his candidacy, June 16th, 2015. A lot of his rallies completely covered. I remember watching the live stream of his Birch Run rally, which was his first appearance in Michigan. One question that does seem to persist is he is saying, I'm going to do great things in trade and our national defense in terms of taxes, on and on. Many people aren't hearing how. I mean, what do you hear that goes beyond the bumper sticker slogan, you're going to get tired of winning? The question is how. We don't hear details.
Sure. Well, at a rally, Mr. Trump is not going to get into details. Amongst his advisors, he is going to get into details. And if the American people demands further details, it is my belief that Mr. Trump will offer those.
I think the American people do want details, especially. Yeah, like, for example, the ISIS plan. I'm not saying anything, but don't people really deserve to know what they're buying when they walk in on Election Day?
I think when we elect a president, we elect him based on his past, based on his reputation, based on what he's already proven. I don't want to know Donald Trump's private plan with his most confidential advisors on ISIS. I don't want to know that, because if I know that, that means that ISIS knows that, and they're going to react. It's the phenomenon when something terrible is happening and then the media knows and then everybody knows and all of a sudden there's no security. There are certain things that I certainly, as a woman, a citizen, an American, wouldn't want to know, and I want to leave that in the hands of my president.
Lena, we know Michigan's Republican Party is certainly having its issues. We just saw state GOP leader Wendy Lynn Day, the grassroots vice chair, losing her party position because she refuses to back Donald Trump. And we hear him talking about the election is rigged, so we're setting up what some feel are some alarming statements prior to the election. What lasting impact do you think this campaign will have on Michigan's Republican Party?
I think it's a great question, Cindy. I was with Wendy on a TV show last week Wendy and I are friends, and I feel for her. You know, it's a very tough situation. Ronna Romney McDaniels is another dear friend of mine. I'm friends with both of them, and Ronna had to do what Ronna had to do, and I stand behind her, and I feel for everybody involved. The Michigan Republican Party is struggled, but so is every Republican Party, and so is every Democratic Party, for that matter, between Bernie and Hillary and everything that transpired there. This particular election, I'm 35 years old, so I've only been involved in a handful, but in my lifetime, and I remember being in elementary school talking about why I wanted George Bush for president, and I've never in my life experienced such divide, such chaos, such disruption. And as I think about being a parent one day, I wonder, is this what will it be like to raise a child in this world when people are afraid to put a Trump sign on their lawn or a Hillary sign on their lawn for fear of wrath and bad behavior from neighbors? I'm very, very concerned. What does this mean for our country? It's an issue far, far greater than the Michigan Republican Party. The Michigan Republican Party is strong. We are large. We are well-funded. We are growing. We're going to make it. Not only are we going to make it, we're going to survive and thrive. I see our biggest challenge is the liberal media. I mentioned this earlier to you, Cindy, our number one challenge going forward is the liberal media.
Lena Epstein is the Michigan co-chair of the Trump campaign, and as she introduced herself in her piece for the Washington Examiner, Jewish woman and a millennial supporting Donald Trump for president. Lena Epstein, it was great to talk with you, and we want to thank you for being with us and sharing your views with us on Stateside.
Cindy, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week, the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame welcomes its latest group of honorees. Five contemporary honorees will be among those inducted into the Women's Hall of Fame on Wednesday night, including my next guest. Dr. Olivia Letts was the first African-American teacher in the Lansing School District. That was in 1951. From that point, Dr. Letts spent her life as an advocate for education, community service, and civil rights. Dr. Olivia Letts, thank you so much for joining us here on Stateside.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Dr. Letts, on your induction into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. I'm wondering, what were your feelings when you learned that you're joining this year's class?
You know, I was very happy that I was selected to be a member, and I had had a lot of support to help me.
And there were 110 nominations, so it's certainly it's great to have to know that you kind of stood out and are now going to be in the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. Take us back, if you will, to when you were first hired to teach at Lincoln School in Lansing. And am I right that it was a sixth grade you were hired to teach?
Well, I was hired to teach the elementary upper grade, so I had taught fourth, fifth, and sixth because it was a very small school, so you didn't always have a full number for one grade.
Now, was this your first teaching job out of school, or had you taught elsewhere?
Oh, I taught for 3 years in Chicago. There were 2,000 students in the elementary school where I taught, so the principal thought I was wonderful, and the reason he thought I was wonderful was because I never sent a child to the office, and he saw me maybe three times in the whole first year.
So you took care of business in your classroom?
Correct, but I was teaching the first, second, and third grade in Chicago.
Now, what brought you to Michigan and to Lansing?
I met my husband at a wedding in Chicago that he brought his mother and sister to attend.
And love spoke, and you came to Michigan.
Well, after we dated for a year, because he worked still in Lansing. He loved Lansing as a city, and he certainly didn't wish to move to Chicago. So I was ready to move here, but I needed a job here, and they weren't hiring people of my color, so we had to work on it.
And what did that take?
Well, Attorney Dunnings, the father, Dr. Harrison, a doctor, and several other folks all went to the before the Board of Education and I had gotten good references from the schools that I had been in Chicago, and so they decided to take a chance and hire me. And then they also decided then they could hire somebody for secondary, so they hired a secondary person as well.
Now, what are your memories, Dr. Letts, of that first year? And I'm wondering, did you encounter resistance? Were you welcomed? What happened that first year?
People came to look at me at the school, but everybody was very kind. I was treated very well. I have nothing bad to say about the way I was treated because people respected me. I respected them. I did my job. You know, I worked from 51 to 54, and my daughter was born in 54. And you did not take a leave then. You resigned. So I resigned in 1954. But I had no problem getting back in 1956 at the same school.
I'm interested, how many African-American students were in your class in those early years?
All of them were, because if a Caucasian came in the morning, by afternoon, they had gone.
What do you mean?
I mean, they went to another school, so they kept it 100% African-American.
Were you thinking of yourself as you were, you had to, as you say, do some things to get hired, and then you came in and, as you said, you just did your job as best you could. Did you think of yourself as making a statement, as being a trailblazer, or were you just there to do your job and see where that led you?
People, you know, would say things, so I had to, you know, acknowledge the fact that I was the first African-American there. But, people just went about their business, and I did the same. And I taught from 56 to 61. The principal was having knee problems, and she asked me to apply for her job as principal. I did not seek a principal job. So I applied and got the job, so I got to be the first administrator in the Lansing schools.
And then went on to become director of elementary education. Dr. Letts, when you look at the teachers who have succeeded you in classrooms today in 2016, what are your biggest hopes and your biggest fears for those teachers in Michigan today?
That there aren't going to be enough of us. So few are going into education now because there are so many more options than there were back then. So I'm just afraid that we are not going to have teachers of all ethnicities in the schools. And the teachers that I know, most of them are retired now. You look at the administrators, and I'm not aware that there are a number of African-American administrators because they're not that many in the schools anymore, and I don't keep up enough to know the exact number. I've been retired, if you can believe it, for over 30 years.
Looking at your career and your lifetime of education, of what are you most proud, Dr. Letts?
You know, that's a very hard question for me to answer. I think I'm most proud of the students that I've had who have succeeded. And I still today see some of those who have succeeded. And that makes me very proud.
Dr. Olivia Letts, the first African-American teacher in the Lansing School District when she was hired in 1951. She's being inducted into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame this Wednesday. You can read more about her and the other honorees by going to MichiganWomen.org. Dr. Olivia Letts, congratulations. It was a pleasure to talk with you on Stateside.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You've likely seen groups like theirs in your local diner or coffee shop.
That group of seniors gathered over their weekly coffee. The topics of conversation can be pretty wide-ranging, and there is a very special bond that builds with each weekly get-together. There's a group like that meeting on Mondays at a cafe in Clarkston in northern Oakland County. And when Bill Haney joined them, he soon realized there were lessons to be learned in the lives of this group. Bill has written, edited, or published over 400 books about Michigan and the people of Michigan. So he was the right person to see a book in the lives of the group that meets at Brioni Cafe and Deli in Clarkston. The book is One Cup at a Time, Why a Gaggle of Geezers Gathers Every Monday Morning to Solve the World's Problems. Bill Haney, good to have you back on Stateside. Welcome.
Nice to be here again.
And we want to welcome one of the gaggle of geezers who actually invited Bill to join the group. His chapter in this book is titled Going Anywhere, Doing Anything, Men Coming Home Again. Wally Nizguski, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
You know, I have to say, as I read your book with the foreword by former Governor Jennifer Granholm, it was really striking. You've got 11 life stories, including yours, Bill's. But I'm wondering, going back, what made you realize, wait, hey, there's a book here?
You know, this is one of the rare ones. Most of the books I've done were an idea that I had, like Ernie Harwell's book, for example. Ernie didn't come to me. I thought we should do a book. This book was right there before my eyes, and I really didn't realize it. My son Mark mentioned to me, after I had told him a story or two about these people, he said, well, you know, have you thought about doing a book on this? And until that moment, I really hadn't, but it made sense.
Why?
Because if we don't capture these stories for posterity, they're gone for good. And I think most people have said at one time or another, I wished my mother, my grandparents had put down some of this stuff. It's lost for all time. And I thought these were interesting stories in their own right and also would shed light on many of the most exciting and difficult years in this country, which were the post-depression, the Second World War, Cold War. And all these people had gone through this and different times were in the same place but didn't even know it, but had different points of view on all of these historic events and then how it shaped their own lives and created their futures for them.
And certainly lessons that any reader of any age could learn from today.
Very much so. It's not just a trip down memory lane for the people. It's also, there are lessons in there, and they're not stated overtly like, learn from this, but I think that anyone who reads it, and perhaps even especially our younger people, will get a better idea of how life was before Saran Wrap and iPhones.
Wally Nizguski, you met Bill when he stopped to buy organic vegetables from you at your stand on Sashaba Road. What made you think, hey, you know what, I'm going to invite him to the group?
Well, it was obvious to me that he was in left field and had a lot of, well, all of us at that table, we're all consider ourselves liberal. I had been fighting Bill for, he says 2 years, but I think it was more like 3 years. He neglected to come. He always had an excuse for not coming. He over complimented me about my vegetables, telling me how important it was, the thing that I was doing. And I do believe that for many years I was selling vegetables mainly for the opportunity to express my views on agriculture.
So you felt he was a fit. He finally said, okay, I'll come. And then you say very quickly, Bill, it became the highlight of your week.
It did. I went because Wally just wore me down, really. And I said that the last thing I really needed in life or wanted to do was to sit around and get into any kind of an argument with people with a different political point of view. Not that I don't respect that. I do very much and find it stimulating. But I didn't want it in a kind of a strident sort of a way. But Wally said, no, I think, and he used the word liberals, I would say progressives, because I think some of these people may be Republicans, for all I know, or independents or Democrats. I really don't know, but we do share in common a value system and a belief in, I think, the essential goodness of people and that you can do something with your life. They may be retired, But yes and no, Wally's not retired, and all of the people in there are involved in significant, important activities, even to including the donating of the funds from the sales of this book to Reading Works to help combat adult illiteracy, which is a crucial need in our society. And the folks there, Paula Brown and her staff, are doing a wonderful job. So that's really the cause that has motivated us to come together to do the book, not just for its own sake, but so that something good comes out of the book.
Bill, you goes to the group, comes on a Monday morning, Wally, and says, I want everybody to write your life story. What did you think when he presented this idea?
It was shocking to even consider being involved in a book like this. And I'm thrilled that I've gotten something on paper. Bill made it seem important that I needed to get some of these things that would be lost in just for my family, if nothing else. And it has evolved into something that I'm just honored to be part of.
It is fascinating to read these 11 stories. Both of you have stories, and everyone else, to get a sense of how far we have come. One of the very first stories I read, the author talks about having to travel to Grand Rapids and how it takes 10 hours to get to Grand Rapids, trundling along on Grand River because there was no interstate system. Getting a sense of what life was like for – I know if anybody has driven through Troy in Oakland County, to see what you, Bill Haney, describe as growing up in Big Beaver Village in the 40s and 50s and contrasting that with what you see in Troy and driving along Big Beaver now, it is pretty astonishing. And then there's the where life takes you. And Wally, your story really jumped out. I'm going to just kind of try to recap, and it really needs to be read to get all the nuances. I know you were born in March 43, just before your dad left to fight in World War II. Yours was the first house on the block with a TV.
Yes.
All right. Now, just to scratch the surface of what Wally has done. Worked at ski lodges, the Detroit Playboy Club. You fished for salmon in Alaska. You were a city marshal in Colorado. You lived in Mexico, New Mexico, Texas. And eventually you and your wife and son made your way back to Michigan. Why was that?
Oh, a couple of reasons. My wife had just gotten her teaching certificate and was ready to apply. And we knew that she wouldn't be – once she settled into a school district, she wouldn't want to move again. My son – he barely knew his grandparents. And the other reason is he here in Michigan, he had 30 or 40 cousins. And he needed to know them. He needed to know his grandparents. He needed to know where I came from. And that is the primary reason we moved back to Michigan.
And I think the thing we sense, Bill, through all of these stories is that idea of being finally looking for roots, that no matter where life may take you, and you were certainly, Wally, quite the explorer. You had a lot of wanderlust, but eventually there is that kind of call to home.
It was a magnet, really, I think. Mm-hmm. Michigan was, and Jennifer Granholm pointed that out in her foreword for the book, which I thought was very insightful about the people that went through these experiences in Michigan in the 30s and in the 40s didn't realize at the time what an impact it had on them. And Michigan has been very special because of the automotive industry, whether you worked in it or you were affected by it, by its ups and downs, and by the union movement in Flint, which is touched on by Jim Reed in another chapter in the book. But to me, what you have here is a mosaic of these experiences. And the irony is that I doubt that any of the people in the book would have thought that someday they would choose to come back to Oakland County, to Clarkston, to the area, and live out the rest of their lives here.
And if anybody is it wanders by Brioni's on Monday mornings, they're going to see the gang together. And if they've read One Cup at a Time, then got a kind of a sense of who it is behind the writing.
Right. And if they wander to Clarkston at 7 o'clock on Wednesday the 19th, we've invited them in with no charge to join us as we launch this book, which is not yet officially out.
Wonderful. The book is One Cup at a Time: Why a Gaggle of Geezers Gathers Every Monday Morning to Solve the World's Problems, edited by Bill Haney. And also we've got with us Wally Nizguski, who's one of the 11 geezers who contributed his life story to the book. It was really great to talk with you. Great reading. Lots of lessons in this book. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing with our series, Minding Michigan, we turn to a deeply personal account of life battling bipolar disorder. Dr. Perry Baird was a Texas-born and Harvard-trained physician. In the 20s and 30s, his medical career was on the rise, and he became more and more interested in what caused manic depression, as it was known at the time. Today, we know it as bipolar disorder. By 1944, Dr. Baird was deep in the throes of the very disorder he was trying to understand, trying to cure. And then he became separated from his family. After being in and out of institutions, Dr. Baird died in 1959 of complications from a lobotomy. Now his daughter, Mimi Baird, has written a very powerful book of her father's life based on a manuscript of his that came to her many, many years after his death. The book is He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. This Wednesday, Mimi Baird will be giving a public lecture at the University of Michigan Depression Center. Mimi, welcome to Ann Arbor.
Thank you, Cindy.
How far back do your memories of your father's bipolar disorder go?
It goes back to probably when between 6 and 8 years old. But you have to remember that I didn't know that his actions or anything other than inappropriate behavior. I was too young to know. Back then, people didn't understand what mental illness was about. At that point, it was supposed to be psychological, that there was something in your family background, some, you know, defining event that made you act strangely. And so I didn't have the perception to understand what I was, you know, witnessing, plus the fact that was the era where you didn't talk about what was happening. The next day was just sweetness and light, as if nothing had happened. Nothing was explained to you or told to you, so you just went about your business.
What kinds of things happen? What are those memories?
I have to be really honest with you, Cindy, and this is so easy to talk with you because you're being so compassionate. Everything that happened in those years were locked away. I developed numbness, which is what one does when you are diagnosed with PTSD, which is what I think my diagnosis is.
Traumatized little girl.
Exactly. When I wrote the book, discovering the manuscript, I had to hold everything at arm's length because it was such powerful material. I was learning about it, you know, for the first time in my 50s, but I didn't react to it. And so now, for instance, talking to you, talking at the Prechter Lecture, and hearing myself reading my father's words, I am now just reacting to what I experienced when I was little. So it's just starting to come out. I'm just starting to react to those suppressed emotions, flashbacks, things of that nature. So I am in the process of it now at my age, 78, which is extraordinary, but I believe better late than never. And this is one of the things that I try to encourage people when I'm talking is if you have something in your family that you think is affecting your life, that you've been bothered by, it is never too late, no matter how old you are, to try to figure that out. Because believe me, it will make your life that much richer. You will understand why you are the way you are.
Because it's walled off. But just because it's walled off doesn't mean it's not in there festering.
That's exactly right.
So I'm sure we're talking about traumatic moments, about physical violence. And even as a child, when you think of hearing your parents having an argument and raised voices and shouting, it is terrifying. You don't know what's going on. And of course, you think it's your fault.
Correct.
So that's a lot to deal with. And so he walked away from the family when you were very little?
Well, I would probably not use that term.
Okay.
It wasn't, he didn't do this because he wanted to.
Right.
He did it because of his incarcerations. His, as we all know, when you have this problem, and this was untreated because they, as I said, psychological, his episodes became more pronounced and he had to be institutionalized longer. So it was only, he didn't walk away from the family. He was taken away from the family because of mental illness. And that's the tragedy. And that's what happens in a lot of households. Your family member is taken away because of the illness. And that being taken away has far-reaching ramifications, which is why the sooner we know what it was like when we were younger, the better it is. Keeping family secrets is not a good idea.
And certainly assuming the way things were in the 40s and not too different in 2016, he was taken away and nobody said anything?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So the wall gets built up.
Yep. Yep.
And there it is. Now tell me about the manuscript, how you came across this manuscript and how many years later?
Well, it's really a remarkable story because it starts off, I was working at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, and one of the senior surgeons in my department, we happened to be having a conversation, and one thing led to another, and he said, "Oh, Mimi," he said, "I knew your father at Harvard Medical School. We were a year apart. I was 51. I had never had anybody talk to me about my father, ever. And most of my childhood friends' fathers were physicians. Nobody. And I realized, because I realized I was making repeated errors in my life, when Dr. Tanzer said, 'I know your father,' I knew that was it. I said, okay." So ironically, 2 years later, I went on a medical meeting. This was plastic surgery department in Dallas, Texas, where my father was from. And I knew that his younger brother was still alive. Looked up in the phone book his name. There were two Philip Bairds. The third Philip Baird was my uncle. And he came to the hotel, and we had coffee before one of my meetings. And he had to air his grievances because he felt that my mother had abdicated her responsibility by not taking care of my father.
Oh, well, the ripple effect through a family.
The whole thing. And the reason she had to divorce my father was because he was violent and untreated for safety for herself and my children. Anyway, so he let his feelings be known, and then I did the same thing on the way back, and I said, "But, you know, our family financed some of the finest mental institutions that my father was in, like Baldpate and McLean, and so I said, I feel that, you know, we're equal here," and so he. I guess he decided that I was okay. And so on the way out, he said, "Oh, by the way, your father wrote a manuscript. Nobody in my family wanted it, but my youngest son, Randy Baird, has it." So for the last three nights I was in Dallas, I talked to Randy on the phone. And a couple of weeks later, came home from work, and there it was sitting on my doorstep.
An amazing thing on so many levels, because it was your father's writing. And in essence, he was trying to figure out, he was trying to work the problem, wasn't he? Science the problem.
He was working it. But what's so astounding, Cindy, is he was working it because he was a doctor. He's academic. He loved to teach.
He's a scientist, yeah.
But he's also, as he's working it, he's experiencing it. So these things are going hand in hand, which when you read the book, you'll see the ebb and flow of the manic. Sometimes he's fine, sometimes he's grandiose, and sometimes, you know, he's really depressed. But he keeps writing. And, you know, I think that writing was so therapeutic. Well, we know when we go to a therapist, they say write everything down.
But journal.
And then his writing is pretty good, isn't it?
Because
you've read the book.
Mm-hmm. It's stunning when I think of you as a daughter being able to see these words he's written, not as your dad, but to see him through these other eyes, to get a fuller picture of who he was and also an insight into his struggles.
Yes.
And so then you had to go through and kind of piece together and put things into context. And that had to have been heartbreaking when you began to live that bipolar disorder in his mind through his words. And then you realize what he thought was a glorious day was a horrific day. Compare with notes from his medical stays. That the emotional tug of that must have been very tough.
Well, and you see, that's what I'm experiencing now.
Yeah.
Because I could never have put together the book and reacted the way I'm reacting now, because I probably wouldn't have lived long enough to do it, because I've done this late in life. But yes, the memories stay with you, and but they're locked up. And fortunately, right now, as I go out, I can remember those, experience them, and I hope I'll be a healthier individual, and my family will be healthier.
I'm speaking with writer Mimi Baird. Her book, He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. He really was one of the first, wasn't he, Mimi, to realize that all of these episodes, this manic depressive cycle, had something to do with the biochemistry of the brain. It wasn't a moral failure. It wasn't, well, if he just wanted to, he'd do better.
Absolutely. And I think what happened is, because he was so bright, he was one of the brightest students at Harvard Medical School at that time, he was taken under the wings of some of the wonderful old doctors of that time, Dr. Walter Buchanan, the famous physiologist, Dr. Fuller Albright, almost forgot that, who was an endocrinologist. And he did work for both of those specialties. And I think that he put two and two from physiology and endocrinology together. And I think this is what fertilized his mind to come up with this, you know, concept. And ironically, his findings of his first experiments were published in June of 1944 when he was a patient at Westboro State Hospital. And then I'll tell you a Ann Arbor story here. My therapist said, Mimi, why don't you write a little synopsis about your father's work, and we'll put it into a psychiatric journal, which came out in Psychiatric Services, Journal of the American Psychiatric Association of that time. Professor Elliot Valenstein, recently retired professor of psychology here at the University of Michigan, and an expert in the history of treating mental illness over the years, happened to see my article. And believe me, it was buried in that
journal. In that journal.
This tiny little article. And he hot-footed it over to the library to look up the scientific paper that was the one that was accepted as the turning point to understanding that mental illness was biochemical, and found out that my father's paper was published 5 years before that of Dr. John Cade of Australia. So one of the things that's so exciting for me to be here today is I am going to get to thank Dr. Valenstein is still alive. He's retired, but he lives in Ann Arbor. I'm going to get to thank him in person.
And what a healing thing for you as Dr. Perry Baird's daughter to say he was onto something, and he did break ground out of that torture of him going through bipolar disorder. Look at the breakthrough that he was able to realize.
And that's one of my, you see, that's one of my focuses, yeah, is for the book, is to restore him to that place in history. It's very important. And Dr. Valenstein did republish one of his books. You can't change the content of a book, but you can add to the index. So he put my father in the index. So it is official, Cindy.
Mimi, that problem of stigmatizing mental illness is as big in 2016 as it was when you were a little girl and your father was taken away and then no one talked about it. What is the solution to that, do you think? That stigmatizing and that fear of speaking out about depression and about bipolar disorder and mental illness?
Well, that's, you see, that I think was one of the huge stimulants for my father to write his work, is the stigma, because he experienced it himself. It's the unknown. People, you can't see it. That you know, if you break your arm, you have your arm in a sling. And that repeated time and again in my father's papers was, I want people to know what's going on so they can understand what it is when you look at somebody who is acting it out or, you know, being inappropriate. Because education and honesty are two tools, and educate and communication. And we know that communication is one of the hardest things that we can seem simple, but it's not. But communicating the facts and the truth about somebody's illness is great for the family. It makes the patient or the person who's afflicted more comfortable with themselves, and it helps your neighbors to understand the family. But I think it's, Cindy, I think it's the unknown. Mm. You can't see it. You can't put your finger on it.
I think of Ron Howard's film, A Beautiful Mind,
yes.
that really opened people up to yes. what life is like as he explored the life of John Nash. And we understood in a very, I thought, deft and skillful way of what it's like to live with the delusions of schizophrenia. And I know that Brad Pitt has optioned your book, and Tony Kushner is now attached with that, to turn He Wanted the Moon into a movie. Do you have the hopes that people may go to see this Brad Pitt movie and you might have similar insights?
Oh, absolutely. And I want you to know that I had long conversations with the two people that head up Plan B, which mm-hmm. is his production company, a man and a woman. And I said, I'm not going to sign this 86-page contract unless I know that you're going to interpret the book with the honesty, respect, integrity, all of that, because this is a serious subject. And I said, I would like it to be like The Beautiful Mind, because that interpreted the book beautifully. And they are so excited about this because it's the first movie they've done about mental illness. All the other ones, Selma, The Big Short, 12 Years a Slave, they've all been addressed moral issues in our society, but they've never done mental illness. And the whole purpose of this is certainly to bring my father's word out there, but to reach maybe a younger generation that is just coming along. And they have their whole life ahead of us, and they need to have some awareness and truth and honesty about what's going on. Because once you know that, you can't help but have compassion.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be a spectacular lecture as Mimi Baird delivers the 10th annual Prechter Lecture for the University of Michigan Depression Center. And you can get all the details by going to PrechterFund.org. That's PrechterFund.org. It'll be at the University of Michigan's Kahn Auditorium. And I think it's going to be just a very, very spectacular evening on Wednesday evening. And what do you hope people will take away from your lecture?
Oh, I just hope they take away some comfort. To know that, my father had been incarcerated, but he was still able to do some experiments. He was still able to write. And with the right kind of care, support from your family, support from your community, there's no reason why somebody who is afflicted with this hereditary kind of illness that they can't lead a productive, happy, and full life. And that's what I want people to know.
Mimi Baird's book is He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. And it's clear you have come to know him. And in that, there's great healing. As you
yes,
say,
thank
no matter
you.
Where you are in your life, there's healing that can happen. Mimi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's show was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.